This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Freight trains crisscross the nation every day, carrying hundreds of billions of dollars of materials, some of which are hazardous. On April 30th last year, two separate trains derailed, one in Lynchburg, Virginia, one in Greenville, North Carolina. The incidents exposed the many risks of transporting hazardous materials on outdated rails. Though there were no casualties from either of those derailments, the events raised questions about federal oversight of moving oil or chemicals on tracks that have not been properly maintained. Reporter Marcus Stern has been monitoring the regulatory responses to oil train explorations and explosions, I should say, nationwide. His work for weather.com in collaboration with the Investigative Fund is called Boom, North America's Explosive Oil by Rail Problem. And Marcus Stern joins us now. Welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I know that your reporting, raises questions about hazardous material by rail all across the North America. You focused on oil and how much of that is being transported. Tell us how much oil is being transported and kind of what led to this increase, because I know it's increased greatly over the last 10 years or so.
Yes. In 2008, there was hardly any crude oil moving by rail. But it was about that time that new fracking technologies allowed oil and gas developers in North Dakota to really start pulling shale oil out of the ground there. The problem was there were no pipelines. And so they're producing currently 1 million barrels a day of oil from North Dakota without the pipelines, Texas without pipelines. So they said, what can we do? And they saw that there were railroad tracks that ran between North Dakota and a lot of the refineries on the coast. And so they turned to the railroads, and they began shipping most of this by railroad, 750,000 barrels a day, I think, currently.
So, and that does represent a pretty good increase. So you got 750,000 barrels a day. Is this stuff any more volatile than oil, you know, sort of refined oil that we might see in an oil tanker on a rail car, on a freight train?
Well, Frank, this is not, you know, the traditional gooey black oil people ordinarily think of. This is much lighter. It looks more like gasoline, and it acts more like gasoline. It has, unfortunately, it's got, when it comes out of the ground, it comes out of the ground with a lot of propane, butane, and other natural gas liquids entrained inside the oil, and they should be removed. But there's some question about whether they've been properly removed or whether these natural gas liquids were loaded onto the rail cars, making the rail cars very dangerous as they move downstream toward the refinery.
And there was one very serious accident that I think resulted in 47 deaths. Tell us about that.
Yes, this was July 6, 2013, and it's probably the seminal event in this whole debate. What happened was an oil train from North Dakota was headed toward a refinery in Canada, Irvine Oil Refinery, and it had a little engine problem, and the conductor was told to just park the train overnight, call a cab, and go to a hotel, and they'd send somebody to fix the problem with the locomotive. Well, what railroads typically do is they leave those engines running, and they leave the train unattended. And this happened to be at the top of a very long incline. 7 miles below this incline was the town of Lac Megantic, a sort of quaint lakeside tourist attraction town. And the brakes slipped on the locomotive, and this train hauling 2.6 million gallons of this explosive light crude on something like 78 cars, rail cars, became a ghost train. It was moving down the track. By the time it reached Lac Megantic, it was doing 60 miles an hour. It hit the curve in Lac Megantic. They derailed, and there were a succession of explosions as each rail car blew. And when each rail car blew, it would send a fiery mushroom-shaped fireball into the sky several hundred feet, and it sent flaming oils across the ground, spreading in every direction. And unfortunately, there was a bar, and it was 1 in the morning. It was full. It was a Saturday night. And as you point out, 47 people were killed. 5 people, they actually never reclaimed any remains. They were simply vaporized. Mm.
So this should get the attention of regulators in the U.S. and Canada, and it does. Tell us what happens next.
Well, I think the regulatory community did what it would typically do. There were some press conferences held. There were assurances that everything would be done possible to make sure this wouldn't happen in the United States. I think many of the regulators saw the Lac-Megantic incident as a fluke, a perfect storm of mistakes. And they really believed that it wouldn't happen in the United States. But right after that, not long after that, a train exploded in Aliceville, Alabama, and it burned 9 acres of timber and wetlands and burned for 3 days before it burned itself out. And it's still being cleaned up. And then there was another explosion in Castleton, North Dakota, and there was a subsequent one you mentioned at the start, in Lynchburg, Virginia, that set the James River on fire. And so I think the debate really, really picked up, and there was a lot of concern from communities around the country that suddenly noticed these oil trains moving through their towns. And they have been pushing regulators, but the process has been very secretive, and it's been dominated heavily by industry interests.
Well, and the industry, particularly the railroad industry, but the oil industry is the other one that would be in play here. The fact is they have a good hand. They own the tracks, and apparently that makes it more difficult to regulate. Is that right?
Well, what happens is that while I'm sure the railroads have a presence in every statehouse across the country, they have a huge presence in Washington. The Association of American Railroads spends something like $60 million a year. I'm not sure if that's the exact figure, but if you look at the railroads and the oil industry trade groups in Washington, they spend over $100 million. I could say hundreds of millions of dollars collectively, some of it on this particular issue. So they have Washington wired really well, and they have controlled the regulatory process really well in Washington. So when these communities push back, or when states like California, for instance, try to act unilaterally, let me give you an example. California passed a law saying that we're going to take 6.5 cents per barrel to give to our communities so that they can prepare for a disaster. Legislation passed, signed by the governor, enacted, and immediately the Association of American Railroads came in and filed suit against the state of California, saying that there's a federal preemption, that these are issues that are decided at the federal level, not the state level.
All right, and that's kind of a reactive response. What do we do if the worst happens? How about proactive in terms of regulation to prevent these kind of things? How much authority does the federal government or state governments have in making sure the tracks and the trains that carry this stuff are safe?
I think that's one of the more sort of disturbing aspect of our findings of spending a year looking at this, and that is that the railroads are largely unregulated. There's 140,000 miles of railroad in the United States, and there are 76 inspectors for those 140,000 miles. We have 70 to 100,000 railroad bridges in the United States. Nobody really knows exactly, because the federal government doesn't keep any inventory of railroad bridges, nor does it routinely do any inspection of railroad bridges. It leaves it to the railroads to inspect and maintain the bridges.
And the government did, after these events, impose greater authority in terms of just accountability to make sure the railroads had a plan for maintenance of these bridges. They authorized, or I guess they ordered the plan, but then the railroads weren't ordered to give them to the government. So they made a plan and I guess can keep it secret. Is that right?
Well, this is I think you might be referring to one of the directive that was put out by the Federal Railroad Administration shortly after Lac-Megantic that said railroads must not leave their trains with their engines running unattended on the tracks, which was one of the key things that led to Lac-Megantic. And it seems like a no-brainer. But there was an incident of some people. I talked to the locals in a town in Illinois. They continue to have a problem of trains being left with the engines running unattended in their town. And one day, one of the leaders, the town leaders, came and saw a train idling with the engines running unattended at 5 in the morning. He saw it again at noon. He went to the police. They called the train company. The train company said they were allowed to do it. I called the train company months later and said, how come you're allowed to do this because that emergency order says you may not? And the train company simply said, we can do it. ultimately, through my reporting, I was able to find out what the emergency order had some small print. It said simply, they simply need to have a plan for keeping these trains, for having trains parked on tracks with the engines running and unattended. But the federal government does not need to see them or approve them.
How about plans for infrastructure improvement? Are there can states or the federal government inspect these tracks and require improvements in certain maintenance standards? How does that work?
Well, again, they'll run into the federal preemption argument. But the bottom line is that these railroads belong to the railroads. And we looked at a 116-year-old timber trestle bridge in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And we wondered if it was safe because when we walked along the base of it, it seemed like a lot of the pilings were rotted. I went to city officials first, you know, the fire department, the civic leaders, the mayor, others, and asked them if they had any concerns about it. And they said, no, the railroads take care of that. And they just assume everything is fine. They don't have the right to go and actually go on the property and inspect it. And I went to the state level, and they just—they also said, "That's not our portfolio. That's the railroads. Up to the railroads." So they're essentially turning a blind eye to the risk in their local communities, and hoping that the federal government and/or the railroads are taking care of their business.
All right, Marcus, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Reporter Marcus Stern has been keeping an eye on America's lack of federal railroad legislation and regulation, I should say. Stern's piece on oil train explosions on weather.com was reported in collaboration with the Investigative Fund. You can find a link at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, an opera about one man's relationship with Muhammad Ali. Hear about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.